Well, 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 welcome everybody. This is Hear Folk Radio, Yahweh's Covenant People, and today is January 11th, 2019. And I am broadcasting.
I just checked, everything's on, out, everything's good, audio's okay. Good, turned it up, and
okay.
Hi, everybody.
Okay, you're breaking up in my headset, so maybe, you know what I'll do? I will just pull you down a hair. Because, ladies and gentlemen, I am broadcasting from my laptop coming from central Illinois. Farm country, we're getting a snowstorm passing through. St. Louis is getting a foot of snow tonight. Lucky for them. And Steve's going to monitor the chat room because I'm working off my hotspot, which I just had to have a new SIM card put in today. It took me 3 hours at Verizon to get this all worked out. But it seems to be working just fine.
He does not have a lot of bandwidth.
Right.
He doesn't have a lot of bandwidth, so we have to keep that down.
Yeah.
I'll take any comment or whatever in the chat room. I've already put the topic for tonight in there.
Okay.
And
Very good.
Means I will bring that up here and minimize the others.
Okay.
Boy.
All right.
That's a big white article.
Right, right. Okay, we're continuing our series on the migrations of the 12 tribes and the identification of the tribes with particular countries and, where the various 12 tribes settled. And we've done Judah and Dan, extensively done Dan. We'll be doing more on Judah. We're not finished with Judah. And we've been doing some general stuff.
They're all over the place.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Now, Zebulon is a little different. Zebulon tended to locate in a particular country. And we're going to be quoting from an article by Hope of Israel Ministries. This is I'm pretty sure it's an Australian website. And the title is Holland Identified with the Tribe of Zebulon. Introductory paragraph here. The tribe of Zebulon, along with the other tribes of the house of Israel, went into captivity in Assyria. What happened to them? Where did they go? Did this tribe end up in Western Europe, as some people believe? Well, all of them did, as we in Identity know. And an article by Peter Salemi, and I'll take the very first paragraph, and then we'll just switch paragraphs, or switch sections, because the paragraphs are pretty short. So I'll take this one introduction and the Tribe of Zebulon heading, which is only two paragraphs, and then you can take Settled in Assyria. The Dutch people have had wonderful blessings in this end time. They have had colonies around the world, have made huge advancements in cartography and the printing press, not to mention its oil stakes in its former colonies, and of course the riches it has in the South African colony. I don't know if it still has that. I'm wondering.
This must be an old article.
Yeah, it must be an old article.
Yeah,
maybe it does still have some kind of South. No, okay. South Africa. I don't know if it means the South African country. Certainly that's not a colony of Holland. All these advances attributed by the Dutch, are these prophesied in the Bible? Can we identify the Dutch with one of the tribes of Israel? Next heading here. The tribe of Zebulon. In the days when the tribes settled in the Promised Land, one tribe, the tribe of Zebulon, settled in the north of Palestine by the sea. Afterwards, this tribe, along with the other tribes of the kingdom, or house of Israel, went into captivity in Assyria. What happened to them? Where did they go? Did this tribe settle in the country we know as Holland? Bible prophecies and tribal identities, along with secular histories, and tracking these tribes shows this to be true. And as we see, God is like a shepherd, moving his people along, guiding them into the places where he wants them to be in the end times. Over to you, Pastor Steve.
Oh, yes. Well, they're right in line with our thinking here.
Right.
On that.
Yeah.
We have said that the tribes of Israel over the years are in Europe and the United States and all these Israel nations wherever the Europeans settled. Pardon me.
Yeah.
It says, settled in Assyria. When Israel was taken into captivity, the areas in Assyria that they were taken to were, and the king of Assyria did carry away Israel unto Assyria and put them in Hala and in Habor by the river of Gozan and in the cities of the Medes. That's a quote from 2 Kings chapter 18, verse 11.
Okay, by the way, this Hope of Israel website, it's pretty much a British Israel type of website. Okay, it's not too seed line. And they consider the Jews to be the tribe of Judah, or at least part of the tribe of Judah. Over to you.
Yes, but when they get facts right, the facts are right.
Yeah.
We can separate the truth from the fiction.
Mm-hmm.
As we dissect this article here.
Right.
When the tribe of Zebulun was taken and settled in Assyria, we see their tribal names in many of the ancient maps. Afghanistan, anciently in the Assyrian period,
quote,
in early Scythian times, the name Zebulun was recalled in Zabulistan, which was to the south and southeast of Hara in the Iranian area. Eldad Hadani, circa 1800 Common Era, he mentioned the tribe of Zebulun in the Paran Mountains, meaning the Parutas by the Zagros to the east of Mesopotamia. Zebulun seems to have been also located in part further east, where there once existed a kingdom called Zabulistan, which was named after a people who evacuated the region sometime prior to the Muslim period.
Uh-huh, interesting.
Zabulistan was associated with the area south of Kabul, that's in Afghanistan, and also encompassed Sakastan.
Okay, Saka
to me, baby.
Yeah, right.
Saka.
Isaac's sons.
It has Isaac's sons, right?
Yes.
It had been colonized by the Scythian hero called Zohak, whose name is actually a variant of Isaac.
There you go.
Zohak was considered responsible for having settled the inhabitants of Zabulistan in their places. And that's page 321, chapter 57, the tribes. Davidi emphasizes his and mine. Here we find Zebulun, known as Zabulistan, in the very area that the Bible said they would be in Hara in Iran.
Very interesting.
With the help of the Bible, we can see the tribal names of the Israelites in these areas of Assyria, now Iran, in these ancient maps and histories, which makes it easier to trace many of our peoples today, including Zebulun and the sons of Zebulun, Sered and Elon and Jachlil, Genesis 46, verse 14. And over the host of the tribe of the children of Zebulun was Eliab, the son of Helon, Numbers 10, 16. These are the subtribal names of Zebulun.
Yeah, by the way.
All right, now I pronounce it Helon because
That's
the Hebrew pronunciation. They just have an H. They don't have the little letter in their typeface that makes it a H.
Right.
But I know it, so.
Right, yeah.
Now,
well, the other name. Yeah, the other name here is Elon without the H. And but I guess it's a different person. But the Iranians, I was going to say, do not consider themselves to be Arabs. They will be insulted if you refer to them as Arabs. And you can see from the Iranian visage that they still have a lot of white blood in them, probably more white blood than the Arabs do. So it's obvious that they were at one time a white nation. Many eons ago.
Arab comes from Arab, which means dusky.
Yeah, and they consider themselves.
The Iranians are very white. They have very straight noses. They don't have the hooked beak.
Right? Yeah, they don't.
They're not.
The Arabs do.
With the Edomites.
Sephardic Edomites, yeah. Yep. Okay.
Oh, boy.
I better lay off the sauce.
What?
All right, please continue.
What kind of sauce?
You know what kind. It's sangria.
you are a saucy person.
Right.
Again, back in the Iranian area, the settlements of Israel in these areas, we discovered also that this name, Zebulistan, the name is also found in the Sabalingoi. The name Sabalingoi means Goi of Zebulon. The Goi,
very nice.
The people, the nation of Zebulon.
Okay, so Saba. Saba
so
is a variant of Zebu.
The people, the Goi, is like Goi, which means nation in Hebrew.
Right, yeah.
Since in northern dialects, Sabalin and Zebulon would have been alternate pronunciations of the same name. The Z was replaced by a capital S, and Goi means people in Hebrew. It's G-O-Y, Goi.
Right.
The Sabalingui were to the north of the Sigulonis, whose name in Hebrew means chosen one.
Very nice.
And of the Saxons, that would be the Isaac sons. And in turn, to the north of the Sabalingoi were the Chali, son of Yachliel. Yachliel in Hebrew, and the Y would have been dropped. Genesis 46, verse 14. Yachliel was the son of Zebulun, as was Sered.
Okay.
As was Sered, and also Elon.
Okay.
Okay. Again, the tribal names of Zebulun appear in the area of Zebulistan, conserving the names of the sons of Zebulun and having the areas named after them.
Okay, so we can trace the linguistic migration of these people, you know, variations of Hebrew names appearing all over the place in what's called today Iran. Okay, so there's no history at all of any black people migrating through this area. So, you know, the idea that the blacks are Israel, you know, this is a very recent invention. I'm sure it's basically
Israelis. Well, it was invented by the blacks.
Right, probably invented by the Israelis.
Well,
paying
they,
them.
They don't like their own identity. They don't like what they are. They don't like themselves. They're self-hating.
Right.
So they have to try to be a different people.
Okay.
Now, we was Kangs.
Yeah, right.
We was Kangs. We had this great civilization. Where?
Right. Well, Egypt.
Where? Show the archaeological evidence of your great black civilization.
Right. Right. K-N-G-Z. Kangs. Right. Kangs of Egypt. Back to you.
Yeah. And they came out with this movie, The Black Panther or whatever, and they got this fake name of this fake nation, and they're all identifying with that.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I don't know who... Oh, yeah, but Paul English was talking to me about this, that there's this... again, it's another so-called black Hebrew myth that Napoleon... shot up the statue of the Sphinx, the face of the Sphinx, to hide the fact that it was a Negroid face. Okay, that's the latest theory coming from the Black Hebrews,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But I know I read the travelogue about this. When Napoleon got down to Egypt, there he did not encounter any opposition. He was expecting opposition. Found none, so that his cannon guys were cannoneers. What do you call them?
Yeah.
Artillery. Yeah. His gunmen. They got bored, so they just started shooting. They just shot
they
it
aimed
off.
At the nose.
Right. Yeah, that's, yeah.
I mean, they were just common guys. They didn't have any sense of history or archaeology
right.
or
right.
value anything, so they just shot the living crap out of the Sphinx.
Yeah, it was just out of boredom. Had nothing to do with trying to erase a Negroid nose. All right. Okay, back to you.
Well, yeah. The last paragraph of this section. After this settlement, the tribes of Israel began to migrate into Europe and Scandinavia. And again, we see these same tribal names appear. Quote, the name is also found in the Sabalingoi of southern Jutland and Frisia, recalled by Ptolemy. From Jutland, that's Judah land, and Scandinavia.
Right.
There appeared several waves of migration into the area of nearby Holland. So the Sabalingoi and Chali, sons of Yachlil, son of Zebulun, may have moved to the Netherlands region. These tribal names appear in Holland among the Dutch people.
Okay, very good. So, and of course the prophecy, it's interesting, I forget what chapter you quoted from one of them already, but I believe it's chapter 49 of Genesis, that prophetic statements were made of each of the 12 tribes. And if the Jews are only one tribe, then you have to ask the question, well, where were all these prophecies fulfilled? Okay, because they couldn't have been fulfilled by Judah only.
Well, if the Dutch are Zebulun, they are of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the Boer people,
right,
are of Israel because
they have a lot
of Dutch. Yeah, there.
They have a lot of Zebulun.
They are Israel, and a lot of them recognize that they are Israel.
That's right. That's right. So they have a lot of Zebulun in them, and they have a lot of Judah in them as well.
Yes.
Okay.
The Germanic, as I do, because I'm German Scots. My last name is Scottish name, but we also had the Andersons spelled the same way, not with an E-N, Andersons, in Germany.
Okay, right. Anderson.
And I am of the family, the royal family up there in Scotland, that we have a castle. We were lords in that land, the Anderson. Yes, I had the Anderson Castle.
Is it still there?
I have photographs of it.
Oh, is it still there? Let's go make a trip.
My father went there during World War II. He was in the Army Air Corps, and he was on leave. And he went there and identified himself, stayed at the castle
for
as
free?
A relative, and brought home our family history and the family tartan.
Nice.
Which the feds destroyed. It's gone. It's lost. But that's our property.
Heritage.
I suppose.
Yeah.
With my birth record, I would be entitled to move there, but I would not move to the UK for anything.
Right. Even if they crowned you King of England? No.
Oh, I'd be taking some heads.
Yeah, right. Okay, all right. Zebulun.
Adolf Richter has in the chat room, but the new history in England showing that England was founded by Africa.
There you go. Oh, yeah, what was it? They have a black hero for... the Vikings. Was it the Vikings? The Vikings were black. Don't you know? Come on, people. Don't you know that? I bet they don't even know what Viking means. It means berserker. They're the berserkers.
They don't have a clue.
Yeah, they don't have a clue.
They just, you know.
Right, yeah.
Whatever.
Okay. Zebulun in the latter days. Now that we have discovered Zebulun to be the peoples of Holland... And he's indicating, you know, there's some Judahites, there's some Danites, and some, but mainly Zebulunites. What does the Bible say about these people? Is the hand of Holland identified? Is the national economy, the national characteristic of Holland, prophesied in the Bible? National economy. Okay, Genesis 49. In Genesis 49, Jacob prophesied what would befall you in the last days. These were specific prophecies for specific tribes. where they would be, what kind of power they would possess, and their national characteristics. Of Zebulun he wrote, quote, "Zebulun shall dwell at the haven of the sea, and he shall be for an haven of ships, and his border shall be unto Zidon." Okay. This is very particular to the coast of, what, let's call it Palestine, because Zebulun did live by the sea bordering Zidon, the Zidonians. Okay. So, the tribe of Dan was nearby there as well. I think Asher also was another seafaring tribe. So Zebulun, Dan, and Asher were all seafaring tribes that lived in the northern, you know, parts of the ten tribe house of Israel. So, but this doesn't mean it can't be fulfilled twice, okay? But you know, leaving Sidonia behind, they would move to another haven of ships, namely Holland. Let's continue. A dictionary definition of the word haven includes the alternate meanings of any sheltered, safe place, refuge, and port harbor, from Webster's New World Dictionary. The Bible prophesied that the Zebulunites would inhabit an area that was a haven, a shelter, a refuge from the sea. Since the Israelites migrated into Europe from Asia, Asia Minor, we need to look for a European nation which is sheltered from the sea. That nation is the Netherlands, Holland. Much of Holland's land is quite literally sheltered from the sea via its dike system, just like New Orleans. So the prophetic description of a haven of the sea is quite apt. The phrase haven of ships indicates that the land of Zebulun must also include a major harbor facility. Indeed, the Amplified Bible translates this phrase as a landing place for ships. Now, I'm not that much familiar with Holland, but the areas that are sheltered by dikes can't also be a harbor. They don't want to open those.
They have a great bunch of seafaring ports up there.
Okay.
They were the big, the Dutch were the big shipbuilders.
Okay.
They built, everybody commissioned ships from them because they built the best, most solid ships.
Okay.
They were famous for that.
All right. Okay. Well, the next paragraph, the Dutch port of Rotterdam has become the busiest seaport in the world. The Encyclopedia Americana states concerning Rotterdam, quote, "Its port in volume of freight handled is the largest in the world. In addition to foreign trade, the port handles the huge barge traffic that is carried on the Rhine River and associated waterways. The port now extends continuously from Rotterdam to the sea." I wish I would like to see a map. "At the mouth of the new waterway lies the great port complex of Europort, Gateway of Europe." So apparently, diked areas of Holland are, you know, not abutting against this port. So this port must be, it sounds from what the description, further inland. Not sure. "Not only is Rotterdam the busiest ocean-going seaport, it is now a gateway to all of Europe via a system of interconnected canals on Europe's mainland." Okay, very good. And let's see, this is a long section here. So let me turn the rest of it over to you here. "His border shall be unto Zidon." Back to you.
Got it. "His border shall be unto Zidon. How is this fulfilled in the latter day?" Stephen Collins explained, "The key may lie in the Hebrew word translated border, which literally means thighs. This Hebrew word is so translated in Daniel chapter 2, verse 32, in the phrase, 'its belly and thighs of brass.' This phrase is part of a description of a body and denotes the lower torso down through the uppermost portion of the legs of a statue seen in a dream, since Daniel 2:33 refers to the statue's legs as being different from its thighs. In other words, the ancient Hebrew word for thighs in Genesis 49:13 includes the pubic area."
Okay, the hips
on
and
this
thighs.
Specific okay. translation, I wish to acknowledge the assistance of Dr. Charles Dorothy, a graduate of Claremont Graduate School, who checked the above analysis for accuracy. How could a reference to the human pubic area point to the modern Dutch nation? Next paragraph. The Dutch capital of Amsterdam is world famous for its red light district. Oh boy. Offering all manner of erotic sinful pleasures in its various sex shops. The CBS television program 60 Minutes, featured in its 1990-91 season, tells you how old this is.
Yeah, right.
A program about the Amsterdam sex district, which includes prostitutes openly peddling their bodies just behind windows at street level. In 1992, the Dutch parliament effectively legalized the prostitution industry by repealing a law which previously had banned pimps.
Yeah, they saw how much money was being made in Vegas.
They wanted to tax it, I'm
right,
sure.
Right.
The ancient Sidonians were famous for officially tolerating sinful sex practices, which were part of the fertility cult practices of Baal.
Oh, so that's where they picked it up.
Wicked Queen Jezebel, whose name is synonymous with brazen sexual temptation, was a Sidonian.
That's right. Got that right. Okay.
Official Dutch tolerance of a major industry in sexual sin parallels the Sidonian tolerance of similar practices and would give meaning to the Genesis 49 prophecy about modern Zebulun being comparable to the sexually sinful Sidonians. The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel found, page 403 and 4.
Okay. Oh, so this is Stephen Collins commenting. Right. Okay. Very good.
Okay. The latter-day nation of Holland fulfills all of the specifics of this prophecy. But there are more prophecies about Zebulun. And of Zebulun, he said, rejoice, Zebulun, in thy going out, and Issachar in thy tents. They shall call the people unto the mountain. There they shall offer sacrifices of righteousness. For they shall suck of the abundance of the seas and of the treasures hid in the sand.
Okay, that can't be Jews or blacks.
Deuteronomy 33, verses 18 and 19. Zebulun was to rejoice in its going out.
Okay. Yeah. What's that? What's the word for explorers? Exploring. That's what, and virtually all of the Israelite tribes were great explorers. Yeah, you can't say it about the Jews. You can't say that about blacks either. Can't even hardly say it about any other race except the white race. Back to you.
Well, when they get into a town, they explore until they find a welfare office.
All right, there you go.
Zebulun possessed a commodious seashore and the fisheries of the Lake of Tiberias, and was therefore to thrive by commerce and to rejoice in his going out, an example, in his mercantile enterprises.
Okay.
The agriculture and fishing industries of Holland are implied here. The Dutch still claim that a Dutchman invented the method of curing herring, haringkokken. Right, that's
okay.
That's cooking herring. By a man called Willem Bukiltz from Beervliet in Zeeland.
Oh.
The Swedish make the same claim. Anyhow, it is a historical fact that as early as 1320 AD, the Dutch used a refined method of salting herring by putting them in their ancient natural salt pans, already desired by the Romans, along the river Schilt.
Okay.
Anybody who knows something realizes the tremendous role the preservation of herring by salting has played during the Middle Ages.
Yeah, it's just like jerky. You can take it along and feed yourself for many months. Okay.
Off of one fish.
Yeah, right.
because one, you have to chew it and
right,
chew it.
And chew it, you know. And chew it. But yeah, herring, you know, man, you go to any deli and you get, you know, salted herring. You know, it's
pickled herring?
Yeah, all kinds of herring. Yeah, yeah. It's I don't consider it a great delicacy, but I've had it, you know. I mean, when you're hungry, it works.
So does Grandma used to cook smelts and herring and all those fish,
right?
And her dumplings, her German dumplings, Grandma Olga. That's a little German name, Olga.
Right.
Her maiden name was Schuer, and her second husband was a Rickenberger.
Uh huh. Okay. Yeah. I'm related to the Reichenbach. Yeah. Okay.
Reichenbach, Texas. Willie and Waylon and the boys. Oh, no. No, that's looking back. Oh, never mind.
All right. Well, let me pick it up from here.
Underneath
the photo.
Underneath the fish.
Yeah, underneath the photo of the fish. Up till recently, it was realized that it was indeed a blessing meant to save entire populations living in the Celtic fringe of Northwest Europe. Well, yeah, any kind of food preservation techniques would greatly, I mean, especially, sailors could live on the ocean by catching fish, but they don't always catch fish. Sometimes they had to, you know, bring along, you know, like dried fruits and dried beef, etc., and herring, and pickled herring. One barrel of salted herring saved the family of seafarers' crew from starvation during long winters of sailing the seven seas. Even nowadays, the herring is Holland's most popular seafood. Every spring, when the new green herrings are caught, it is a mad international race between Scottish, Danish, Dutch, Russian, and other fishermen as to who will get the first one. After that, there is a traditional Dutch race for the first boat of the fleet to be home. The first herring tube back in Holland has the honor of presenting the green herring to the queen. I wonder if they still have a queen. Who, of course, eats it raw, as every good Dutch man and woman does. Huh, I don't know if I'd do that. Anyway, ever seen a Dutchman at a fish stand gulping a herring down his throat? An old leftover custom from Zebulon. It is remarkable that the fishing port, no, well, what is it? The oysters, right? A lot of people like slurp oysters down right from the shell. It is remarkable that the fishing port of Scheveningen at the Hague coast claims to be the largest herring fish harbor of all Europe. The fact is that for 300 years, the Dutch herring held a monopoly on the European market. In the 16th and 17th centuries, there were 2,000 herring tubes, that's boats, and 1/5 the entire Dutch population industry. That's a lot. Think of that, 1/5. And think of all the other inhabitants of the Netherlands having such Zebulonitic occupations as shipbuilding. And, of course, many of our tribes had that. Very advanced from those days, even Tsar Peter the Great from Russia came to learn shipbuilding here. Draining, piling, making nets, building dikes, repairing harbors. You know, since the vast majority of the Israelite tribes had huge, shipbuilding industries, and the Jews never have, that it's obvious who, you know, and Dan abode in ships that that they sailed up the rivers of Europe in. Okay.
Well, okay. I mean, their little mythology has long since fallen apart. They just can't support the fact, you know, oh, we're God's chosen people, we're Israel. No. Sorry. You just don't meet all the criteria.
Yeah, no.
You don't have any of the traits.
None of them.
Of Israel. You just don't have it. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oy, okay. You schmuck.
Okay, I didn't realize Zeeland was in Holland, and that's pronounced Zeeland, okay, meaning sea land, the land of the sea. Think of the retired fishermen, the elderly men, who sit talking all day in the harbors. One may say that almost all the Dutch lived and worked at least part of their days at the seashore or natural harbors, fulfilling the blessing to Zebulun. Okay, and Zebulun, Dan, Asher, all those northern tribes abutting the sea, they were all seafaring tribes, and even the ones that weren't, they were also capable of building ships and going out in the oceans. In the 16th and 19th centuries were the most blessed periods for Holland, being internationally the heyday of fishing and shipping, when the expression made sense. Every Dutchman is a fisherman. Also connected with the fisheries is the textile industry. I wonder how this works. The tribe of Zebulun in the land of Israel was occupied in the purple dye industry. Oh, okay. In the making of white glass. And in fishing. White glass? I don't know what that is. White glass. Maybe he'll explain. The purple dye was produced from a sea mollusk by a complicated chemical process, and the dye then applied to textiles in a manner which has also required expertise. Modern Holland is prominent in both the chemical and textile industries and also metallurgy. The product of white glass uses what could be considered metallurgical principles. Now, maybe it's literal, that it's a glass that has a white tinge to it, or is, not transparent, translucent white. But, interestingly enough, Pastor Steve, what does the word Phoenician come from? Any idea?
They talk on their phone. They talk on their phones all the time.
Phony. They're Phoenicians. No, the Phoenicians were named after the purple dye. Okay. So, any chance they could have been Zebulunites, Danites, Asherites, etc., the Phoenicians?
Yeah.
Okay.
Very good chance of that.
Here's another connection, the purple dye industry. As for
that's when Dan left Egypt up along the coast before the Exodus, a great deal of the tribe of Dan, the seafaring tribe, they joined up and were sailing with the Phoenicians because they were allies or kinfolk or whatever. So much has been lost over the years.
Yeah, and this purple dye was one of the major exports because they knew the trick of how to produce this purple dye. It's used to, tint clothing. And and that's probably how the industry of Phoenicia got going, by shipping out this purple dye. Okay, and so the production of white glass uses what could be considered metallurgical principles. As for agriculture, the abundance of cows in Holland made fresh milk to churn butter and produce the famous cheese that has been exported and enjoyed around the world. This agricultural abundance in Holland yielded riches to the farmers in their golden days of free enterprise. Its nature gives the Netherlands its wealth. So rejoice, Zebulun, in thy going out. Okay? Well, great exports. And, just about all of the Israelite nations are exporting nations. Hard to say that throughout history. Hard to say that of any black African nation, if there are any black African nations. And the Jews, what did the Jews produce for export?
Prostitutes.
Yeah, right.
Homosexuals.
Right. Right. Yeah, debt. They export debt, right?
Yeah, usually. Like Wisconsin. With the cheese industry up here, those are all Dutch people that settled in America.
Right.
And they brought that trade over with them, and they're famous.
Okay.
For their cheese and butter, and when they brought out margarine, they passed a law that oleomargarine is illegal in that state.
In Wisconsin, right?
Because it's only a couple of molecules away from plastic.
Right. Yep. Okay, you want to take it from here in this section?
Oh, let's see. In the latter part of that prophecy, it claims that Zebulun would suck the abundance of the seas and of treasures hid in the sand.
Okay, that certainly is not true of the Jews. What
well,
do
they
mean
just
here?
Suck. They suck everybody.
Right.
They're abundant suckers.
right. The only thing the Jews have to do with the sea is one time a Jew looked down at the seashore from a hilltop, and he saw some silver object shining in the sunlight. He ran, oh, it's got to be some silver. So he ran down to the seashore and found it was a dead fish. So he pawned it. Okay. Yeah, right. Back to you.
Right. There are some jokes I could tell, but I won't. All rolling over and over and over, fighting over a dead carp.
Right.
The connection with Holland is obvious. The Dutch literally sucked out the sea via their system of dikes and windmills. Not to mention, in 1962, Holland discovered a huge gas well under the northern Netherlands and North Sea while boring for oil, sucking gas in abundances from the sea.
Okay.
What a treasure for the Celtic fringe this new gas belt has become.
Okay. So we do the exploring, the digging, and the adventuring, and the finding of new products all over the world. Okay. Unlike any other race or group of people in the world, you know, the white race, the Israelites, specifically the Israelites, fulfill all these prophecies of Genesis 49 and others. Back to you.
Yep. The phrase treasures hidden in the sand refer to the same thing, and its meaning also identifies the Dutch. What treasure frequently hidden in the sand has become critically important in the modern world? The answer is petroleum, and one of the biggest, largest worldwide oil companies is Royal Dutch Shell.
Also owned by the Rothschilds.
Formerly, huh?
It's also owned by the Rothschilds.
Oh, well.
Even though it's Dutch.
Right.
Uh-huh.
The Dutch nation formerly had overseas colonies of its own, the largest of which was oil-rich Indonesia, known for centuries as the Dutch East Indies. Indonesia became independent of the Dutch after World War II and is now a member of OPEC.
Wow. Okay.
However, the Royal Dutch Shell Oil Company is still one of the premier oil-producing companies of the world. It is unique in that it bears the name of a modern European country in its corporate title, unlike Exxon, Standard Oil, Mobil Oil, etc.
Uh-huh. Exxon and Standard are also owned by the Rothschilds. I don't know about Mobil.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
They bought them up.
Right.
The other treasures of the sand are, of course, diamonds.
Huh.
No historian ever denied that South Africa is mainly a Dutch plantation.
Okay.
Used to be, but that's not true
yeah, used
anymore.
To be. Right,
this
not
is
anymore.
An old article, right. About 30 years old, evidently.
Yeah, right.
The interest of the Dutch East India Company with their speedy flyboats in the 17th century were mixed in with the missionary activities of the young Protestant Republic in the 16th and 17th century, with its many refugees, mainly Huguenots, who have formed the bulk of the Dutch settlers in South Africa.
Okay, to be distinguished from the Boer people,
yeah,
who are a combination
Cape
of...
Cape Dutch.
Right, yeah, the Cape Dutch are different from the Boer people, not the same.
Right.
Okay, back to
They're
you.
They're the Huguenots, and they left the Huguenots behind because right. They were kicked out because they didn't have any Huguenots.
Right.
The Huguenots, so they had to leave.
Yeah, you can't get on a ship without a Huguen.
That's right.
There you go.
Undoubtedly, their going out has become a blessing for that land. My puns are so bad.
Yeah, so are mine. Our puns aren't working too well today. Falling flat. just
like a herring, like
behind,
a dead
right,
herring.
Like a dead herring on the seashore.
It's still strange that there are groups in South Africa today who see themselves as offshoots of
right.
Zebulun through their descendancy from Holland. That
right.
would be the Boers.
Can you imagine how how disappointed that Jew was when he came down to the seashore and it turned out not to be silver but a dead fish. What a disappointment. Back to you.
Yeah. The diamond industry in South Africa is now the supplier of all the world's diamonds, and they're all owned by Jews.
Yes. Dutch Jews, British Jews, all kinds of Jews. Yep. But mainly Dutch and British Jews, yes.
No Hugen Jews, though.
Nope. South Africa, I think, is the...
South Africa. I'm cracking up. South Africa, the former Dutch settlement seen as an offshoot from Zebulon, is the land of diamond mining. Almost like a symbol of the largest rough diamond has been discovered in South Africa, the Cullinan in Transvaal in 1905. This one was sent to Amsterdam to be cut and is now part of the crown jewels of England.
Okay.
Amsterdam, the capital of the Netherlands, has been for ages been famous for its diamond cutting industry, its cleaving, dividing, and setting. This hand process, in which generations of mainly Jewish diamond workers of Amsterdam have excelled, is still the best.
That's because
right in this article.
Right, right. That's because they monopolize the business. They won't let it. They won't let anybody else do it. Okay.
Right. South Africa produces most of the world's diamonds, which, on the whole, are processed and traded with in Belgium. South Africa is dominated by the Boers, used to be, who mainly descend from the people of Flanders, are considered to be of Dutch affiliation.
Okay, let me... let me correct this. According to Pastor Martins, a lot of the Judah Boer people are actually Germans. And they were falsely labeled as Dutch because they came in on Dutch ships, okay? Because the Dutch were the only ones that had ships going down there. But the Boer people considered themselves primarily to be German, not Dutch, okay? So there, that's the difference, ethnic difference, although they're obviously related. But the Boer people have always considered themselves to be separate from, you know, these other tribes, the Dutch and the other South Africans. Back to you.
Right.
Okay.
It is interesting how in the Jewish Encyclopedia, which is based on ancient Jewish tradition, the diamond is mentioned as the symbol of Zebulun.
But they're not.
Zebulun, the stone of Zebulun on the chief priest's breastplate was a diamond.
Okay. Very good. All right, let me start the next section here. Let's see, we have about 10 minutes left. Deborah's blessing on Zebulun. In the book of Judges, when Deborah was the leader in Israel, and after their victory against the Canaanites, she prophesied with the Spirit of God that out of Zebulun, they that handled the pen of the writer. Okay. Judges 5:14. Zebulun wielding the writer's pen. This means skilled in writing. The word pen here in Hebrew means branched off stick or scion for punishing. See Strong's exhaustive concordance for writing or fighting for ruling. Okay, so branched off stick. Well, we know that the tip, you know, I suppose you can use a tip of a stick to write with, but usually a quill was like a feather of a bird. Let's continue. It was specially used in this sense to inscribe, okay, to recount, to number. The word used here is sefer, which is known in the Bible as the word for a book or a roll. Maybe
that's sefer.
Sefer, okay. I think
that's where the accent is. Sefer.
Yeah, I think
on the last e.
Okay, I think he means scroll. I think scroll, a book or a scroll.
Well, scroll, a rolled up parchment.
Right. It is therefore not out of place to associate with the means with producing books and printing letters. From Strange Parallel by Helene Coppion. History shows that but a Dutch man named Coster of Haarlem in Holland is considered by some scholars as the first inventor of printing, Encyclopedia Britannica. Very good. The printing press led to the freedom of the printed word of God and the availability for the average citizen. From the book Strange Parallel, here is a lengthy quote in the history of the printing press and its role the Dutch had to play in it. I've never heard of this part. It is still generally accepted in the Anglo-Saxon world that it was a German, Gutenberg, who invented the printing press. I've never heard anything different. The Dutch have always disputed this on good grounds. Oh, shut up. And recent discoveries in Germany give even more credit to the Dutch claim. Okay, you want to pick up the rest of this here?
Yeah. Here is the Dutch story behind it, which, by the way, millions of Dutch have been taught at school to be the truth.
But only in Holland.
In the city of Haarlem, right? There is a statue in the marketplace of a man with a letter block in his hand. On the stone is inscribed 1440 A.D., Typographic Letteris Mobilis a Metallo Fusus Inventor, or the inventor of the art of printing with movable letters of cast metal.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Coster, having invented this primitive way of printing with lead types, was robbed of his invention on Christmas night of 1440 AD by his servant Jan.
Wow.
Fled with it to Mainz in Germany, where it eventually came into the hand of Gutenberg, who seems to have refined the method and produced the famous Gutenberg Bible in 1448.
Okay, now wait a minute. No, not to doubt this story at all, but why couldn't Coster go ahead and just produce another set? All right, and maybe he died shortly thereafter. But, okay, this is very plausible here. I never heard of this before. Okay, please continue.
After a centuries-old tug-of-war between the Dutch and Germans, there's a vast literature pro and contra. A conclusion seemed to have been reached recently, since a 15th-century chronicle has been rediscovered in Cologne, as Germany, mentioning that before Gutenberg, prints were already made in Holland. Moreover, as a result of research, there is evidence that astronomical calendars in Mainz exist, printed in a more primitive style than Gutenberg's. Are these examples servant Jan brought with him? Anyhow, Coster printed such astronomical calendars in Haarlem in Gutenberg's time.
Okay, so Haarlem... Yeah.
And there was only a few of them, so they were astronomically expensive.
Right? They still are. Right? Slap, slap, slap. Okay. Interesting. I actually operated a machine of this type while I was in the military.
Yeah, I did too. I took a trade in junior high school, typesetting.
Uh huh. Okay. Yeah.
Did it by hand. Then they came out with all the machinery.
Right. Right.
We were using all the little lead type, and they had all those decorative little racks.
Uh-huh.
And you didn't have to look. You just automatically knew where the letters were. And
right.
And you would set the type, and they would grade you.
Yeah.
Because that's what they used in the printing industry during that time. Well, by the time I got in high school, that was all gone.
Right, right. You know, same for me. When I was in the military, coming back from Vietnam, I operated one of these machines. It stamped out dog tags for soldiers. Okay.
Yeah.
So that was my job at one point. Back to you. That was fun. It was really a fun job.
Yeah, you used steel, though, where the type for printing was lead.
Uh-huh.
And printing lead, ingot lead, is still the best for bullet making.
Oh, okay.
Guys that cast their own bullets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, very good.
All right.
Okay.
See in Dutch, Modern Encyclopedia of World Literature, 7 volumes in Dutch, under Coster. In English, the Encyclopedia Britannica, Volume 2 and Volume 18, 1961 edition, Onto the heading, printing still names Gutenberg the strongest claimant to the honor of the invention of printing. And because Lawrence Coster of Harlem is the only man whose name can be connected with these prints, whose work is much more primitive than that of Gutenberg and therefore assumedly preceded this, he is considered by some scholars the first inventor.
Okay.
Oh.
All right. Okay. All right. I'm not going to challenge that. even though I'm a proud German.
Yeah. We're almost out of time.
Yeah.
If you take a look at the clock.
Yeah, we got about 3 minutes left. Okay. All right. So. Yeah, and we're just about at
you
the end.
You want to pick this up on the next one?
No, next because show? There's very little left. There's only we're down to about 7/8 of the entire article. Okay. So, did you put the link in the chat room for everybody from Hope of Israel?
I sure did earlier.
Okay.
Sure did.
So they can follow this on their own and the other marks, and we have the Royal Seal, Holland's Ship of State Seal, Seal of Amsterdam. You know, a lot of these symbols are based on. Well, here we see the lion rampant. Okay, there were no lions in Europe. There were certainly no lions in Britain. So why is the lion so common among Israelite tribes, even in modern, symbolism? It's because we used to live in territory where there were lots of lions, namely Palestine. Okay, there were.
Yep.
Okay, that's why we have this. Now, of course, the black Africans can say that too. All right, but I think by the time the Israelites inhabited Palestine, most of those lions had been killed. But there were still a few, because the Old Testament actually talks about people being killed by lions even in those days. Okay?
Right.
So there were a lot of lions there, but never in Britain, and as far as I know, never in Europe. Here in America, we have mountain lions, which is a completely different animal from the lions of the Middle East. Okay? And today, of course, there's no lions left. So this is where we get the symbol of the lion, folks.
Well, later on in this article, it calls the boar the Afrikaans population.
Yeah, they make that
boars
mistake.
Boars and the Afrikaans are not the same people.
Right, yeah. And even Pastor Martins didn't realize that until about 2014, when he had the vision, and an angel told him, hey, you got to differentiate between the Boer and the Afrikaners are not the same people. And he's created quite a stir in South Africa over this teaching. But it is correct. It is absolutely correct, because the Boer people have a tradition of being Israel and a completely separate a Bible and church from the Dutch and the other Afrikaners. Okay? So, and a completely different lifestyle. They married without priests, just like the old Israelites did in the Old Testament, okay? Which shows that they are true to the Old Testament more so than the Hollanders were, okay? And any other churches down there. Okay, Pastor Steve, I think this is pretty good evidence that Zebulon landed primarily in Holland, of course other places as well. But this is tracing our migrations from Palestine to Europe. There's no doubt that Zebulon and Holland are related. All right? Okay, thanks, Pastor Steve. Thank you all for listening. Praise God, we passed the ammunition. So glad that I'm broadcasting from my laptop again. Everything's working again. 2019 looks to be a good year. Thanks for listening. Praise Yahweh. Pass the ammunition. See you all next time.
Praise Yahweh.
Okay.
Okay.
It stopped on time. Very good.
Yep, this is...